Hi, everyone. Just a quick note that only half of this episode is available for public consumption. The rest of the episode is only available to our Patreon subscribers. If you'd like to become a Patreon subscriber, you can go to patreon.com/psychpodcast. That's patreon.com/psychpodcast. For as little as $5 a month, you'll get access to all ad-free Patreon-only episodes. Also, there are other tiers available that will give you an opportunity to join the vibrant psychology podcast community, ask your own questions of new guests, and even have a 30-minute Skype call with me each month. Also, if we reach our monthly goal, we will donate 10% of all proceeds to an organization dedicated to helping people with their mental health. So go to patreon.com/psychology and become a Patreon subscriber of the Psychology Podcast today. That's patreon.com/psychology. Okay, now let's dive in. Welcome to the Psychology Podcast, where we give you insights into the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity. I'm Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman, and in each episode, I have a conversation with a guest who will stimulate your mind and give you a greater understanding of yourself, others, and the world we live in. Hopefully, we'll also provide a glimpse into human possibility. Thanks for listening and enjoy the podcast. Today, it's great to have Kitty Herzog and Jesse Single on the podcast. Herzog's writing has appeared in an array of publications, and she is a former staff writer at the Seattle alt-weekly The Stranger. Single is a contributing writer at New York Magazine, where he previously edited Science of Us, a behavioral science vertical. He also has a newsletter where he writes about behavioral science, media, and other stuff. The other stuff part being a lot of other stuff. His book about half-baked viral psychology, The Quick Fix, is coming out in about a year. Together, Herzog and Single co-host the Blocked and Reported podcast. So great to chat with you today, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much.
Do we have anything to discuss today?
How's the weather where you are?
Yeah, the weather is beautiful, actually, so please don't hate me. But you're making a lot more money than I am, so...
I don't know about that.
We can discuss the above-ground pool I have planned with our Patreon earnings.
Yeah. I was wondering what, like, the next stretch goal is. Like, if you hit 10,000 a month, you guys will donate half the proceeds to the Psychology Podcast? Is that it?
Yeah, that was under discussion, yeah, of course, naturally. Yeah.
I think right now the only plan is that Jesse's going to make pizza for every single one of our listeners if we hit $10,000 a month.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
Can it be gluten-free? Some of it gluten-free?
Absolutely. Scott, that is blasphemy. Gluten-free pizza, come on.
Well, it's
you're
not...
You're going to lose us some Patreon subscribers, Jesse.
But you'll get the celiac people loving you. Okay,
true.
Trust me.
That's true.
And that would include me. Okay, so look, I want to actually start off and ask you guys where you first met each other, because it occurred to me the other day, I was like, was I witnessing the origin story? Remember we went to the bar after that Heterodox Academy conference, and you guys were just so intensely talking to each other, and I was like, and I kept looking over to talk to you two, and you two worked so intense that I was just like, I'm just gonna let you two be. Is that one of the first times you two talked to each other
in person? I think, right? But Katie, didn't you originally reach out to me because we were writing a story on the same subject?
Well, so I reached out to you while I was working on a piece about detransition because I read your work. And part of the story that I thought that I was working on had a section about sort of backlash to talking about detransition stories, which didn't ultimately make it in the piece. And I don't think it needed to be in the piece, but it was sort of my way of like hedging against criticism, was to add like all these stories about people who had written about trans issues in a way that sort of got them dogpiled for whatever reason. And so I reached out to you, Alice Strager, a few other people. But I had been reading Jesse's work for a while. And then so we corresponded over the course of several months. And then the first time we met in person was in New York. We met right before the Heterodox conference. We like had food and beer or something. But you saw us right at like one of our early conversations.
Right on. Legendary historical moment that I witnessed.
Yeah, exactly.
So you two are quickly making waves. Now, can you maybe just both of you just go one by one, just introduce yourself? I did a bio, but if you could just introduce, how would you like to be viewed as?
I'll let Katie go first because she's smarter than me.
I'm actually not smarter than Jesse, but I'm funnier than Jesse, which is worth more, it turns out. I guess I think of myself as a media critic primarily. As you mentioned in the bio, I was a staff writer at The Stranger, Seattle's Alt Weekly, until recently. I was laid off in the wave of COVID layoffs. And so now I'm doing some freelancing. I've written a couple pieces for The Guardian and The Atlantic since the layoff, but mostly what I am is a podcast co-host. That is now the most important part of my identity now that people are actually giving us money to do this. But my interests are fairly aligned with Jesse's and probably with yours in some respects. I'm interested in psychology and human behavior, particularly why humans sometimes do such crazy things. Before this, I wrote a lot about climate change and the environment, but I find that parsing a human consciousness is more interesting to me now.
Cool. Jesse, how do you, what are some things that are core to your identity these days?
Man, that's a good question. I have one foot a little bit in academia because when I was 27-ish, I left a sort of permanent freelancer job at the Boston Globe where I'd been doing opinion writing. I went to public policy school and I learned more about psychology, economics, statistics, and it really turned me away from just straightforward this is right, this is wrong opinion writing. I got much more interested in why people believe what they do. Led me to a lot of thinkers like Danny Kahneman, John Haidt, just this whole universe of a different way of looking at things where it's less, you don't believe in gay marriage, so I think you're bad, and more like, why did you come to some, such different conclusions about morality as I did? And I think there's a way to do that where you don't lose sight of your own beliefs, but you just understand how complicated the human brain is.
Yeah, for sure. And that's my introduction to you is your writing on the replication crisis, I believe at New York Magazine. I thought it was really well done, Jesse. So that's where I first encountered you. Now, why did you decide to start this podcast together, Blocked and Reported? Why did you decide to start it together?
You want to take that?
Yeah. It's such a weird time, and COVID makes the last, when we started in March, right?
Yeah. Wait, did we? I think we started, I don't know. Time has ceased to have any meaning, but it might have even been April.
It might have been April. So Katie and I have had similar experiences where we run up against this thing where in liberal and lefty journalism, and we're both firmly on the left by any conceivable metric, certain subjects are very difficult to talk about. And when I say this, people caricature that position as though what I'm advocating is like phrenology or race science, when really, I think like what's going on now is a good example where there's a lot of complexity to the protests going on, to the question of how to reform the police. And I think a lot of people feel like they can't talk about this stuff openly. They can't weigh costs and benefits, what policies we should pursue, how race and class intersect. So that's the classic kind of single Herzog issue where we have, I think, traditionally gotten ourselves in trouble on Twitter for maybe speaking about it a bit too freely. Do you think that's fair to say, Katie?
I do, yeah. I think that Jesse and I tend to both be motivated by data and by empirical evidence and things that can be tested, and a little bit less by emotion. And that probably makes us like less fun to hang out with than most people, and maybe a little bit too like oh, let me explain to you how the world works using numbers. But it's not necessarily the sort of, I think, dominant personality trait among much of the media right now. And it puts us at odds with a lot of other people. And there seems to be a desire for that conversation. The response from to this podcast so far has been like sort of overwhelming. We're getting a lot of messages from people who say things like, thank you for making me feel less crazy. And so I feel like, that's kind of the goal for me, at least, is to, besides make enough money to get in a Bob Brown pool to make people feel less crazy, because I feel crazy right now.
Yeah, I completely echo that goal of making people not feel crazy. I also think we want to carve out a space where, like, I don't think Katie or I want to give up our identities as progressives. And a lot of the people who get caught up in some of the craziness right now sort of change their political identity entirely because they feel so unwelcome, especially online. And I think that's unfortunate because, the question of who's meaner on Twitter, is the left meaner, is the right meaner, that shouldn't determine your politics. Your politics should come from core aspects of your identity and your values.
Says you. Your opinion. So why do you think it's, let's really zoom in on why your podcast has taken off by storm. You're at what now, 5,000 a month on Patreon?
5,800, Scott.
Okay.
Well, sorry. That was very snooty. I should be clear. Katie and I had no idea this was going to happen, and yeah, we're sort of in shock about it. But yes, we're at 5,813 as I look at this, less than a month in.
If we were in normal fields like tech or something, this would be like, this would be pennies. But as a journalist, this is like the equivalent of J.K. Rowling's money.
Oh, come on. And as a scientist, then it's, you know, let's be realistic. As an academic, I really want to zoom in, though. Like, what do you think is the people that are signing up? What are they craving? What is the underlying basic human need that you're fulfilling from a Maslowian perspective?
So you want like actual, which part on the pyramid of the hierarchy needs? Or?
I think we're shelter.
Yeah, we are shelter.
At this point, you're shelter. Yeah. And then what's the storm that they're trying to come away from? The media?
Social media.
Yeah.
Katie, and Katie should run with this. This is good. We're shelter.
Right now, we've talked about this a lot on the podcast, and I keep coming back to this one phrase, the pressure to conform. I think people are really experiencing that within, and especially because of the pandemic, and we're seeing people less in person unless you go to a protest. So much of our communication now is filtered through social media and online. And there's not a lot of room for nuance and debate, talking about difficult issues, as Jesse mentioned. And I think that what we're providing for people is just a way to listen to two people talk about these things that isn't driven by ideology, that isn't strident. I hope that we're not, I'm okay with us being know-it-alls, but I hope that we're not the sort of people who, I don't know, pressure others to conform to their opinion. So I think that's what it is. I think people feel like genuinely nuts right now, and they don't know how to talk to their friends about it, because they're scared if they do, they'll get excommunicated. And so they listen to our podcast instead.
And we should say, like, this isn't some idle concern. Like, just today, a 28-year-old data science guy at Civis Analytics, which is a big data and polling firm in DC, all he did was tweet that there's some political science from this African-American studies professor at Princeton suggesting that violent protesting and rioting leads to a political backlash. That's a very important finding. He got fired, capital F fired, just for tweeting that. I think this is an outlying case, but when people send us messages, this is increasingly the sort of thing they're concerned about, that if I tweet the wrong thing or say the wrong thing, there's going to be disproportionate consequences.
Yeah, I hear you. And Katie, you said something that really stuck out at me on Twitter the other day, and we'll be going through a lot more of your tweets in a second. But one that you said that really stuck out at me is you're like, I've never felt more free in my entire life. Look, that really hit home for me as well. What do you view as freedom then?
For me, it really comes down to not having bosses. So right now, I mean, if I were trying to make it as a freelancer right now, a freelance writer, or if I were trying to get a staff job, I would be really constrained in what I can say. And this is not, like, my views are very normative. I'm sort of a regular, milquetoast liberal. I'm a registered Democrat. I don't think I believe anything, you know, outside the Overton window at all. But when you work at a media job, at a staff media job, particularly right now, there's an attitude that everybody who doesn't conform to the same narrative is wrong. And if you're wrong, you are bad. And if you are bad, you are evil. And there's a real cost to that, because people feel afraid to say what they want to say, you know, and people are getting fired. There was that analyst that Jesse mentioned. There's been lots of cases of this, particularly people in academia, which, you know, you would think they would be more protected, and in media. Now that Jesse and I are creating this business where we're not, my ability to say what I want isn't constrained by the fear that my coworkers, besides Jesse, are going to get mad at me. I just don't have to worry about it. I mean, so much of my sort of internal brain space and stress, but what I had a job at The Stranger was trying to figure out what I could say and what I could say in a way that wasn't going to get me either a talking to, or my boss I didn't want other people to sort of have to, you know, pay for my sins. So my bosses would get emails. I didn't want that to happen. And I just don't have to worry about that anymore. You know, I'm sure that there's something I could say that would probably make our Patreon followers leave, or Jesse could, or maybe when Jesse writes his rap for his rap about the replication crisis, which was one of our stretch goals.
I think you should both start taking pictures of what you're doing with people's money.
Oh God!
Instagram different pictures of like, look, we're on a jet.
That might be the thing that would make everybody stop giving us their money.
That's what I'm thinking.
But unfortunately, I don't think $6,000 a month will get us there yet. So that's what I mean by free. I don't like right now, especially in the media, if you say the wrong thing, if you believe the wrong thing, if you say that you don't think Woody Allen's book should have been pulped by his publisher or whatever, there's a real danger to that. And I don't have to worry about that anymore.
Yeah, I can see why you would feel free.
But this is also like, I'm in a very unique position because, and one of the reasons we're in this unique position is because Jesse and I do have this sort of freedom in some ways and other people don't. And so we can say the things that they can't say.
So at the same time, we have
independent podcast wealth privilege. So that's what I mean. It's not, I also like haven't left my house in like 3 months. So it's a weird sort of freedom.
Me neither.
But at the same time that freedom is being restricted for everybody around us, we have this newfound ability to like support ourselves by saying what we want.
Yeah. And so it sounds like this dynamic that you describe, the stranger, is going on at the New York Times right now, right?
Yeah. I think it's going on everywhere.
Absolutely. And what pisses me off about this is, there's a subset of journalists who will go on Twitter and loudly claim, A, that it's not happening, B, anyone who claims it's happening has a suspect political agenda and is just, you know, wants to be a Ben Shapiro fan or a far right person. Katie and I both get tons of emails from people in journalism and academia. That's safe to say, right, Katie?
Oh, yeah.
And they send us those emails because they know we're going to be sympathetic. Why would you send an email about your workplace situation to someone you think might, you know, screen cap that and make fun of you on Twitter? So I think people who are sure this stuff isn't going on should consider there might be a reason you're not hearing from the people affected by it.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, it hadn't even really occurred to me. So what happened is at the New York Times, for your listeners who don't know, so the New York Times published an op-ed by Senator Tom Cotton that essentially argued for sending the national troops into the U.S. cities and states to quell the civic unrest or civil unrest. And then there was a huge amount of pushback from the staff. And then Barry Weiss, who's a staffer there, basically wrote a series of tweets saying that there's a civil war inside the New York Times. And the response to that was a bunch of her colleagues saying that this doesn't exist. And it hadn't even occurred to me until Jesse and I had this conversation that some people in the New York Times probably weren't lying. They really didn't or like aren't even aware that this thing exists because the only message that they're getting is the one they already believe. It's just, we're all surrounded by confirmation bias, which is, it's just sort of remarkable to me. Like you really don't even realize. It's very strange.
Well, what do you guys do to try to get outside of your own bubble on your podcast?
I think it's been easier as I've developed. So I think the average, say, reader of my articles and my chunk of our fan, like the chunk of our fans who came in via me versus via Katie, is definitely left of center. They're sort of like Obama liberals, but there's also been a subset of sort of genuinely centrist and right of center people. I would imagine the percentage of our listeners who are Trump fans is very, very small, but it's slightly, I've interacted with a slightly wider array of people than I would have, say, when I worked at New York Magazine in 2016. Just hearing other voices and hearing their critiques of liberal ideas and lefty ideas, I think is important just as sort of to exercise your intellectual muscles and your skepticism muscles. So for me, that's been a big part of it. And also just, I'm curious if Katie feels the same way, but there's a subset of issues where in the course of being a reporter, I've learned a great deal about them. And then I've seen how they're covered in other more ideologically conformist outlets. And that has shown me that I need to be skeptical because I see stuff printed on the screen that I know is not true. And it's been a little bit of a, can we swear on this podcast or no?
Sure. I'll have to mark it explicit though.
No. Okay. I don't want to drag you over that threshold. It's been a mind bleep. It's been a mind bleep to honestly like get into these specific nitty gritty areas and then see how these controversies are covered by Vox or BuzzFeed or the New York Times, it has to make you a little bit more skeptical just as a living, breathing, thinking adult.
Yeah, it's a discomforting experience in a lot of ways to when you become familiar with an issue and you see media outlets reporting falsehoods, like repeating misinformation, it's outlets that you trust. It's destabilizing in a lot of ways, you know, and I don't mean that in sort of a Donald Trump fake news way, but just so much is just colored by ideology and bias that when you see that, it becomes difficult to unsee it. And in terms of getting out of the bubble, I talked to conservatives, and this is something I didn't do before 2016. But after Donald Trump was elected, I had a feeling that Trump was going to be elected. I predicted it about 6 months before. And after he was elected, the shock by everybody around me, I lived in Seattle at the time and, you know, we're in these sort of hyper-liberal media circles, and just the utter shock by everybody around me, most people who didn't know a single Trump supporter and who were proud of that fact, just really showed me that if the media wants to reflect what's happening in the world, we have to talk to people we disagree with. And it's such a, like, that shouldn't be a revelation, right? It should not be a shock that you need to speak to people who believe things that you don't believe. But I went out of my way to start doing it. And now I wouldn't say that I have like great friends who are conservatives, but actually maybe I do. You know, I have like, I hang out with like some libertarians now. Before all of this stuff happened, I thought libertarians were just insane. I thought they were crazy. And now I find that I agree with a lot of their positions, and not entirely because my politics have evolved, but it just turns out like there's a lot of civil rights issues, there's civil liberties issues that I, you know, believe in the libertarian position, which is often also the liberal position or used to be. So I try now not to judge people as much on who they voted for. You know, it's just, I don't think who we vote is necessarily a reflection of our worth as a person. And I enjoy talking to conservatives. I find it oftentimes easier to talk to conservatives because there isn't this sort of pressure to agree. You know, we don't have to deal with the narcissism of small differences. And it doesn't become as heated. I know that I'm not going to be on the same ideological page as somebody who's actually very conservative. And so we leave the conversation not feeling sort of angry about it. So I think I've learned a lot more about the world and about how people work since I've started talking to people who don't necessarily agree with me all the time.
Can I add one quick thing to that? We've said some stuff on the podcast, obviously, that listeners disagree with. And, you know, I did a long interview with this leftist thinker, Ben Burgess, I really like. Some people disagreed with aspects of it. The difference that I've noticed lately, and there's some selection bias at work here, in the way liberals and conservatives express disagreement, and again, I want to kick it to Katie after this to see if she agrees. A lot of people on the left seem incapable of just disagreeing without also couching it as some sort of sign of
morality.
Yes, moral degradation on the part of the person they disagree with. Conservatives will say, you know, I disagreed with this, here's why, and they leave it at that. They don't, obviously, if you go online, you'll find people who will call you like an SJW cuck or whatever, but the conservatives I've interacted with are weirdly more capable of just disagreeing and acknowledging disagreement than people on the left, which I find very frustrating because I think that's an important skill to build.
Yeah, well, people on the left would counter, or those people you're referring to on the left would probably counter, that's because they have morals.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So if you don't even know what it means to feel like to get outraged by things because you don't care, then of course you can talk about it more calmly. But now I'm not saying that's my position. I'm saying I could see it. I see a devil's advocate. I think that this increasing communication and increasing the communication, the synchronicity of the communication style is really important. So regardless of what direction is what, if you have people who are really angry and coming from a place of rage, anger, and the way the state of the world is, and you've and others trying to communicate with you through more of a different, you know, modality of human existence, it's just going to be talking past each other, right? So I wonder how we can do that without telling people, you know, the more you tell people just calm down, the more have you ever tried that, Jesse? Telling an angry person just calm down?
I think I have an answer to that, which is if someone comes at me on Twitter and they're very mad at me, I will ask them to explain to me exactly what it is I've said that they disagree and why they disagree with it. And often they're unable to do that. They're just mad at me, but they don't know why. So I don't think saying them to calm down is the right answer. I do think if you're mad enough at me to come at me on Twitter, I have a right to say, what is it you disagree with? Tell me exactly. And if they can't answer that, they're not worth engaging with.
Yeah, I think I like Jesse's tactic. I don't know that it changes people's, actually, it probably changes the minds of the observers. I think it could have some utility with that. I wonder if it works as well with the people who've already decided that you're trash. And this is something that I feel like I'm struggling with right now is, how do I talk to people about these things who don't know that they're happening? All of the sort of the cultural revolution, sort of moral panic that I think we're in the midst of right now, a lot of people don't see it. And I want them to see it because I think it's dangerous. And I don't know, I mean, other than like going to their house and, you know, blasting the podcast outside their windows until they listen, I don't know how to convince people to just be a little bit open to this idea that something's happening. I was hoping you could answer that for me, Scott. You're the psychologist.
Open to what happening in particular?
Open to seeing that something is going on that they might not be aware of.
Oh, it's something just, outside of their own perspective.
Something outside of their own perspective, right? I think there's such a people, especially on the left right now, are so convinced of their sort of moral righteousness that if I say something like maybe people shouldn't be fired for, you know, having like worn a stereotypically Puerto Rican costume when they were, you know, in college or whatever. How do I make people see this?
Well, this is interesting. If people you're describing on the left are morally righteous, would you say there's an equivalent on the right of maybe not moral righteousness, but truth righteousness? Like they think they have the answer. Is there a different kind of righteousness on the right?
Oh, I think absolutely. I mean, you know, think about Christianity. I think Christians probably tend to be more conservative. I think they're utterly convinced of their, you know, righteousness. And I also don't think there's anything I could do to, you know, I can't convince someone who believes that the world was made in 6 days and that gay people are going to hell that the world wasn't made in 6 days and there is no hell. And I think there's, you know, the commonality there is that it tends to be very religious in both cases. I don't think I can talk someone out of their belief.
To be clear, I think Katie's going to hell, but for reasons completely unconnected from her sexuality.
Personality.
That's an important point, I think, because like, I went through years of like, to the extent people got mad at me, it was people on the right. Like I went through years of that, which might not be visible to people now, but there's a subset of people on the right. I don't necessarily think it's worth engaging with. If they wanted to have a good faith conversation, I would. But part of the reason some of my focus has been on the left is I think there's trends here that could hurt the left in the long run. And I feel like this is more sort of my extended family. But all these dynamics, again, you know, you're a social, you know this, Scott. Like these are human dynamics. And I've had conservatives explain to me that whatever sociopathy you see on Twitter, you could find that in like small town churches, where if you say the wrong thing at a luncheon, you're ostracized from the group forever. This is just, we're all just primates concerned about status and in-groups and out-groups. It's the same thing wherever you look.
Yeah, I think the reason in part that we think this is so much more prominent on the left is because we're on the left. This is where we see it. This is also a reflection of our own echo chambers. But I'm sure if you go to some like, you know, small town church Facebook group, there's drama and infighting and, you know, people say the wrong thing and get kicked out.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, a lot of it is ego. Ego's being threatened and you're seeing group egos being threatened. So if you're strongly identify with something and your group is not being respected, then that becomes the most important issue to you out of any other issue in the world. And then it gets really problematic if you really want to talk about how messy humans are. If you zoom out a second and realize, oh my gosh, every group's the same way. See, yeah. The fact is every group thinks they're the only ones that are the victims.
That's called the bias. It's like the bias, right? We think everyone else is biased, but we're the rational actors.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, everyone else is biased and we are the rational actors.
Right, I was going to say Blocked and Reported happens to be the only podcast free of any bias on the planet, so I don't want to detract from that message.
Yeah.
Okay, you might have pulled the hat trick there, but the thing is, I would like to have empathy and compassion for everyone. So I would like to, I think the ultimate state to be in is one where we we try to listen to everyone's viewpoint, and it doesn't mean that we agree with it, but we try to have a dialogue where everyone acknowledges everyone else's viewpoint. But of course that, you know, that kumbaya gets tricky when we talk about people who think in terms term of zero sum games. And that's what the world is at right now, is zero sum thinking.
But can I use your platform, which despite your kind words, your platform is much larger than ours. And I just want to make a quick
that
point about, think about it this way. There is a guy who didn't graduate high school in Ohio or Kentucky in an area ravaged by the opioid crisis. He has a lot to fear from the police. The police do no-knock raids. They use weapons in an irresponsible way. They do civil forfeiture, where they can just take your car on the thinnest of premises. All this stuff happens in poor white communities. I'm not saying it happens as much statistically or whatever. The point is, if you care about politics, there's a message you could say to that guy in Kentucky or Ohio that would raise him out of the tribalism, that would make him think he has something at stake in the battle for police reform. If you have that opportunity, why would you instead tell him the opposite, which is that as an evil conservative Trump voter, he has no part to play in that movement? That's where the question of sort of civility and political efficacy intersect, as far as I'm concerned, because a lot of the messaging going on right now, it's just designed to sort of rev up the people who are already converted, not to sort of increase the number of people on board.
Well, you've entered tricky territory, my friend. But I will say I am working on an article right now trying to get at the root of some of this. And what I think you see a lot of is, you know, having the victimhood mindset actually gives you a power play over others. It lets you get resources. It lets you have immunity from immorality and like retaliation. Like if you retaliate with violence, well, you're the victim, so that's fine. You'll get empathy for it. So there's a whole set of things that come along if you can have a victimhood mentality. Now, I'm sure not saying whether it's justified or not. I'm not making a blanket statement and saying everyone who acts like they're a victim is just trying to get a power play. I want to be clear, I'm not saying that. And everyone knows having a superordinate goal is the only way to bring together humanity. Like psychologists know that.
It's a contact hypothesis, which everyone is ignoring, even though it's like a really important idea.
Yeah. Can you elaborate on that a little bit more?
Oh, sorry. I didn't mean to talk over you, Scott. But
I was on a roll, Jesse.
Sorry. No, the reason I rudely talked over you is this really gets my goat. Is like the best evidence for bringing people of different groups together, and it's like all psychological evidence, it's context dependent, it's complicated, is the contact hypothesis. That's it. That is, if you have people of different groups and you can put them in a situation where they have a shared goal and have equal status to the extent possible, you can get beyond these group boundaries. You can have them, you know, feel like they're part of a superordinate group or have a superordinate goal. And a lot of the discourse I see on some of the most important issues in the country seems much more geared at dividing people up than you know, conceiving of a way to bring them together. Also, you're the expert. Did I just describe the contact hypothesis clearly?
Yeah, totally. Accurately? You're right. And that's what I meant by, you know, the superordinate goal, having that a humanity, you know, something that rallies us all together as human first, as opposed to identity or group first. It is tricky because it seems like politics now has become a tool for winning as opposed to policy. Does anyone remember the days when like policy was supposed to be thoughtfully used as a way to help humans, you know, as a species, you know? Now it's become a dividing tool. What do you think of my thoughts on the victimhood mindset and how sometimes you can kind of get stuck in this trap where you actually don't want to get out of it?
Oh, yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, you can observe this every day on social media for sure. I saw a paper that was floating around this week that I didn't read that from the dialogue, it seemed the paper seemed to be saying that victimhood is a stable personality trait.
Yep. Yeah, that's what I'm writing up right now. That's okay. Yeah, I've been in touch with those authors about trying to connect that to collective victimhood, which is another construct. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm a little more torn on it because I absolutely agree this dynamic goes on. And well, especially in light of this idea that victimhood brings status, we should emphasize that Katie and I have been victimized more than anybody.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's huge victims.
That said, I'm always torn on this because like in a country that really was built on staggering unfairness, I want to hear, you know, if someone says they're a victim, there's often merit to that claim. So it's like you can sort of you can go too far in either direction. You can say, as soon as someone says they're a victim, they are a victim, they should be treated as a victim. Or you can sort of adopt the victimhood mentality as your overall model for explaining the world and suggest that any claim of victimhood is unfounded and shouldn't be taken seriously. So I just think there's maybe a Aristotelian middle ground somewhere in there.
There is. I mean, the ultimate would be for all humans to come together and say, we're all victims of discrimination. We want to work together to fight discrimination. That's one way. That's one model.
Yeah, no. I definitely get what you're saying.
I wonder how much of this is conscious on the part of the people engaged in it. I do think this sort of, maybe victimhood is just a meme. Maybe this is just another thing like floating through culture. I mean, I'm serious. It's just, I don't think that in the, I can't imagine that like our grandfather's generation sort of got, sort of social status from victimhood. I think masculinity and power and other things were the status getters at that point.
This is the Jason Manning, Bradley Campbell theory, right? Victimhood, the idea that we have this whole new system that valorizes victimhood, which I was very skeptical of when they wrote that book, which I haven't read, but at least on Twitter, it is absolutely the case that if you claim...
Skeptical thing I didn't read.
Yeah, exactly. That's what journalists do.
There is, sorry to interrupt you, Jesse, but there's, like, I was doing a radio interview yesterday with a conservative talk radio guy out here in Seattle, and I said something about, I'm not really sure what the context is, but I said something about how, about privilege. And he said, well, you're not privileged because you're gay. And he's gay too. And I didn't sort of push back on that because the conversation just moved on. But there is that narrative that because of these particular demographics and historical oppression that I, a lesbian in 2020 should feel oppressed. And I absolutely do not feel oppressed in any particular way. But there is this sort of assumption, like if you check any sort of minority status, you are automatically a victim. Even if you're, even if you're wealthy, even if you're educated, even if you're gorgeous, Chrissy Teigen was sort of recently the cookbook writer Alison Roman criticized Chrissy Teigen, and Chrissy Teigen was portrayed as a victim of racism in that, even though, she's one of the most successful women in the world. It's strange. It's so strange.
You don't have to have a victim mentality even if you've been a victim.
That's also the question is does feeling like a victim help people? And you guys know way more about the data than I do, but I mean, if you just think about John Haidt's work, I mean, it seems like resilience, what we should want as individuals and as a culture is resilience and the ability to get past adversity, not wallow in it, just for our own mental health. I mean, I don't think feeling like a victim necessarily makes people happier.
It's a very interesting question that I know people like Coleman Hughes and Jonathan McWhorter have been trying to really grapple with, is from an African-American perspective, when will there be a point where, is it reparations? Is it a collective sort of cultural apology? It is clear that we're not there yet. Like, there still needs to be something in order for African Americans to feel safe in our country, to feel like they're part of they're part of it. They're part of American culture and they're cared for. It seems like we're not there yet.
Yeah. No, and you can also understand. I mean, we're just now pulling down Confederate statues. Like, can you imagine? Sorry, this is just one of those issues where I'm absolutely in line with the so-called social justice warriors. But like, if you were in a country and they I can absolutely understand why they might feel that way. I just wanted to throw it. Like, I think this stuff is complicated and Black public opinion is incredibly complicated, but I get it.
Yeah. I mean, I try to listen to perspectives and not claim I definitely know what I'm talking about. And I also open to the fact that, being born Black gives you a different experience in America. Just like being born with a learning disability, I had a kid, gave me a different experience as well. We all have these different experiences, then we should listen to each other's stories. But no one's really listening to each other's stories right now, are they? I just feel like they're just willing to rip their heads off.
No, not at all. It's sad.
Yeah.
Hey everyone, if you'd like to listen to the rest of this fascinating conversation, please go to patreon.com/psychpodcast and become a Patreon subscriber. For as little as $5 a month, you'll get access to all ad-free Patreon-only episodes. However, there are other tiers available that will also give you an opportunity to join the vibrant psychology podcast community, ask your own questions of new guests, and even have a 30-minute Skype call with me each month. Also, if we reach our monthly goal, we will donate 10% of all proceeds to an organization dedicated to helping people with their mental health. So go to patreon.com/psychology and listen to the rest of this episode today. That's patreon.com/psychology. See you over there.